Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
It was news that set the publishing world ablaze.
The fondest wish of many a book lover is about to come true at midnight with the release of a second book from Harper Lee.
As booksellers prepare for the midnight release of Go Set a Watchman, fans of Harper Lee's first published work, To Kill a Mockingbird, are shocked.
Harper Lee's new novel, Go Set a Watchman, shows Finch in a different light. Set in the 50s, the story describes how Finch's daughter returns home and grapples with her father's view on race and segregation.
Fans who had cherished Harper Lee's widely read To Kill a Mockingbird for decades opened their new books to find the gentleman lawyer Atticus Finch twisted from saintly father to racist paternalist. How could this be? And what does this new view of a fallen hero tell us about the Finch of To Kill a Mockingbird? This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Harper Lee's scholar, Thomas DiPiero, is dean of the Dedman College of Humanities at SMU and has read her second published novel, Go Set a Watchman. He joins us now to discuss the relationship between the two books and whether this new work threatens Mockingbird's place in the American canon. Tom, welcome to Think.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
First of all, what do we know definitively about when this book, Go Set a Watchman, was written and how its content relates to what's in To Kill a Mockingbird?
Well, I think what we know is that it was written in about 1955. It was written before To Kill a Mockingbird, and the story in the press is that this was the first novel that Lee wrote and that she took this to her editor, and her editor suggested that she put this one aside and rewrite the story both from the point of view of Scout as a child and setting it back about 20 years prior to the events in Watchmen.
Putting one book aside and starting over is not quite the same as a first draft, but a lot of people are calling this that.
That's right. And in some respects, I think of this as a kind of prequel sequel. In some respects, I think of this as a laboratory for To Kill a Mockingbird. Clearly, many of the characters and the events are the same, but it's not the same novel at all. It's entirely different. And some of the controversies surrounding the identities of the characters and what happens to Atticus, I think what we need to do is to think about this as a different novel entirely. But on the other hand, we really can't. It's almost impossible to read Watchmen not in the context of To Kill a Mockingbird.
There's a lot about the tone here that feels like Harper Lee had just finished reading Catcher in the Rye.
Well, I mean, we're talking about the same time in which it was written. It does have something very 1950s about it. Certainly Holden Caulfield, I hadn't thought in those terms, but Jean Louise has some things in common with Holden Caulfield, not the least of which is she has some developmental issues. She's not quite comfortable with herself. She's older than Holden is, but she's not quite comfortable with herself in her adult skin. And in some respects, that's what this book is about. There are some elements of Watchmen that differ sharply from Mockingbird. Mockingbird has often been called an American Gothic. And while Jean Louise has some of the kind of borderline characteristics or areas in which she's not comfortable in her own skin, she doesn't have the same kind of gothic attitudes that we see in Mockingbird.
As a scholar of Harper Lee, was your process for reading Go Set a Watchman different than it would be for you just picking up a novel to read for pleasure?
It's difficult sometimes to separate out what you read for pleasure and what you read for professional purposes. And I kind of suspect that my own guilty pleasures, which I won't reveal to you, would surprise some people. But I also get a great deal of pleasure out of reading the way a scholar reads. That said, when I first found out about Watchmen, I was very excited to read the new work. And as I began reading it, I read it first, the first chapter online, the way everybody else did. And I was a little disappointed with it. The tone seemed off to me. But when I got the book, I devoured it right away. And I think it was impossible for me to read it not thinking about which elements reappeared in Mockingbird and how things differed from Mockingbird.
The big takeaway for many people in this discussion is that Atticus Finch here is decidedly less a champion of equality than, at best, a complacent defender of the status quo that really favors white privilege. Jean Louise comes home for a vacation, and among other things, she finds that her father has been reading racist propaganda, that he attends a citizens council meeting run by vocal white supremacist, warns about desegregated schools. I think a lot of people who are talking about it haven't read the second book yet. But you have argued this is still the same Atticus Finch. It doesn't have to be a different character than the one we fell in love with in To Kill a Mockingbird.
Well, I think we want to think about this. These are two different books. And despite the fact that they obviously have a great deal in common, the Atticus of Watchmen is not the Atticus of Mockingbird. I think there are more similarities between them than some people are letting on. Let's think about the highly ethical, highly legal Atticus of Mockingbird. This is somebody who has dedicated his life to the law. And in fact, that sentence, something almost like that sentence, comes up in Watchmen. But there's a major difference. Atticus, we know from his ethics, he takes the case, the rape case in Mockingbird when it's appointed to him. Some people have argued, well, why didn't he just pick it up without it being appointed to him? He took it almost against his will. In Watchmen, he takes the case, he picks up the case. But I want to direct our attention for a moment to the end of Mockingbird. After the Finch children are attacked by Bob Yule and they're rescued by Boo Radley, at the end, the sheriff, Heck Tate, comes to Atticus and he says, Bob Yule fell on his knife, even though both Heck and Atticus know that Boo Radley killed him. And they, the two of them together, conspire to not tell the truth. So in the end, Atticus, who is Mr. Ethics, Mr. Legalistic, breaks the law after he's told his children how important the law is. Now, one might argue he breaks the law for a higher purpose. He makes a righteous decision, some people argue, to protect Boo Radley. But it's still against the law. And so one has to question the ethics there.
And of course, he believes he is qualified and justified to decide when it's appropriate to break the law.
That's right. And he is in a privileged position to be able to do that. Certainly, no other characters or very few other characters or people are positioned to do that. And that's part of Atticus's privilege. So he lives his life according to the law, but keeps himself external to it.
All right. I want to play something here for you from Dana Williams, who is professor of African-American literature at Howard University, chair of the English department there. She recently spoke to WBUR's On Point.
There is a passage where Scout is arguing the top of her lungs with her father, and she says, we've agreed that they're backward, that they're illiterate, that they're dirty and comical and shiftless and no good. They're infants and they're stupid, some of them, but we haven't agreed on one thing and we never will. You deny that they're human. So to suggest that he's not racist is blind or a willingness to submit to a racist system that really accords whiteness with privilege, and how incredibly difficult it is and how unwilling people are to really retreat from that privilege. As long as it's extended to you, you don't have a sense of what it does to people who are oppressed. It's not an evened portrayal at all.
Did we mistakenly assume, Tom, that Atticus Finch couldn't be a racist because he did an ethical thing in support of a black person in the Deep South in the 1930s in the original novel?
This is a really complex issue, and I think I take Dana Williams' point completely. And it's a question of how we think Atticus different in Watchmen from Mockingbird. There's really nothing inconsistent in these two Atticus, in the two versions of Atticus. What we get in the Atticus in Watchmen is a more nuanced version. And if you think about what Uncle Jack says, that's Atticus's brother, he doesn't find Atticus's position in Watchmen unusual at all. He says this is a white Southern gentleman. I don't mean to imply that all white Southern gentlemen are racist, but the people are complex. Harper Lee, if nothing else, is a genius at human complexity. So I don't think we need to think of these as two different versions of Atticus, nor do I think we need to try to excuse the racism that Atticus displays in Watchmen. I think what we want to do is discuss that more fully.
It occurred to me reading this book that one of the reasons that racism is so hard to talk about in this country, and I think particularly hard for white people to talk about, is that we've decided as a society that racism is so poisonous that anyone who is racist cannot possibly be a good person. Yet we've all known people that harbor racist attitudes or at least benefit from racism and privilege without challenging it. And we know them to be good in other contexts. And so that conflict makes it very hard for us to have a frank discussion because we like to put people in categories. All racists, we assume, have to be bad. And so that doesn't leave much room for anyone to have some good things in their lives and also have racist attitudes that need addressing and correcting.
Yeah, that I think that's right. And I think it's too easy to say so-and-so or something is racist, and then you can kind of wave it away with a wave of the hand. And that, again, doesn't let us treat complexity and consequently address the actual problems, many of which are at the foundation of our society and our culture. To say that Atticus is racist denies us the complexity of the character. To call an individual racist is just to foreclose that person, and as you said, say, and they are consequently bad. But it's difficult for me to imagine anybody who does not harbor certain kinds of racist attitudes or beliefs in spite of the best efforts to get around them. If someone does something that is racist or recognizes in him and herself some opinion or belief that they later determine is racist, that doesn't make them bad. That makes them good for questioning themselves and for trying to figure out how they respond to other people in their culture. What I think we need to be doing is investigating these complexities and not be so willing or eager to dismiss people with a wave of the hand, but instead to address the complexities of race in our culture.
I want to know how self-aware you think the second novel is not written in the first person, but in the third. But it's definitely told essentially from Jean Louise's point of view, the adult scout's point of view. How self-aware do you think she is? Because frequently in this novel, we're told that she is colorblind. She thinks of herself as colorblind. People who know her say, your problem is you're colorblind, so you don't understand racism. And yet, there are multiple times when she really notes who's black and who's white in a room. When she goes to visit Calpurnia, the family's former housekeeper, there's a line, and I have to read this. The book says, she followed him into a dark parlor to which clung the musky sweet smell of clean Negro snuff and Hearts of Love hairdressing. That line, I don't know how a colorblind person could think that way. Granted, I'm thinking in 2015 and not 1955, but it was very hard for me to keep reading after I saw that.
In fact, the phrase clean Negro comes up repeated times in Watchmen and in Mockingbird. Yes, Scout says she's colorblind, and yet she lets herself make these kinds of observations which belie that claim. That said, there's a difference, and this is why I think I want to come back to the question of complexity and to the kind of the different kinds of distinctions people make. Clearly, there's a distinction we want to make between Jean Louise and Atticus. Nevertheless, Jean Louise, for as colorblind as she claims she is also incredibly self-blind. And in many respects, this novel is about her coming to terms with being an adult. I think of Watchmen as being, in some respects, almost the opposite of To Kill a Mockingbird. To Kill a Mockingbird, as you pointed out, it's first person. It's told from the point of view of a child, but it's got enough of a delicious irony in it that this is a child who is much more aware than she should be, even though she makes some interestingly naive remarks. Nevertheless, she's got a wisdom that will only come with age. So Mockingbird is told from the point of view of a child, but from an adult perspective, whereas the exact opposite happens in Watchmen. Watchmen is told from an adult's point of view, but it almost narrates Jean Louise as somehow somewhat childish. In the last discussion, that very long discussion with Atticus, she repeats the phrase, I don't know, over and over again, and in some respects declaiming the responsibility that she's putting before him. So a lot of this is about her coming to terms with her father and becoming an adult.
Thomas DiPiero is my guest. He's dean of the Dedman College of Humanities at SMU. We're talking about Harper Lee's second published novel, Go Set a Watchman. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter @ChrisBoydThink.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can apply now for fall and design your own master's degree at SMU, a customizable evening master's degree for working professionals. More at smu.edu/MLS.
The witnesses for the state, with the exception of the sheriff of Macon County, have presented themselves to you gentlemen, to this court, in the cynical confidence that their testimony would not be doubted. Confident that you gentlemen would go along with them on the assumption. The evil assumption that all Negroes lie. All Negroes are basically immoral beings. All Negro men are not to be trusted around our women. An assumption that one associates with minds of their caliber, and which is in itself, gentlemen, a lie, which I do not need to point out to you.
You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. You just heard Gregory Peck in the 1962 adaptation of To Kill a Mockingbird for the screen. My guest this hour is Harper Lee scholar Thomas DiPiero. He is Dean of the Dedman College of Humanities at SMU. We're talking about Harper Lee's second published novel, Go Set a Watchman. Listening to that, you know, plenty of Americans, of course, read the novel and have read the novel since it's been published. Millions more came to love the story because they watched the film. How did the film version differ from the book? Did Gregory Peck give us a different Atticus Finch than Harper Lee gave us?
I'm not sure it was different so much as he enhanced it dramatically. That the character of Atticus really took its form through Gregory Peck's interpretation and embodiment. And Gregory Peck said through the end of his life that was his favorite role he ever did. And I think many people reading To Kill a Mockingbird read Atticus's lines through the voice of Gregory Peck. And when you watch him, you see him. In fact, the clip that you played is one of the most iconographic moments. The whole trial scene is what sticks in people's minds, especially the point in which he exits the courtroom. So in many respects, Gregory Peck solidified that character. One has to wonder, without the film. Now, one of the very early reviews of To Kill a Mockingbird in maybe 1961 criticized the novel because the reviewer, and I forget who it was, said that he or she thought Harper Lee wrote the novel specifically so it would be adopted to film. And that was seen as kind of a cheap shot.
A gauche.
Exactly,
right.
Exactly. But I think that adaptation, that's Horton Foote's screenplay, there are significant things left out. The entire section of the novel that deals with Aunt Alexandra, who is a major character in Watchmen, that's all missing from the To Kill a Mockingbird as a movie. The rest of it, though, is a pretty faithful adaptation. You can sit with the novel in front of you and listen to the dialogue. It's very similar. But again, an adaptation to film is mostly dialogue, and what you don't get in the adaptation is the irony I mentioned to before, which is Scout's voice simultaneously as a young girl, but knowing more than a young girl should know.
I want to set aside Aunt Alexandra for a minute because there is a lot of really interesting feminist content in Watchmen and looking back also in Mockingbird, but it's more subtle. We'll talk about that in a minute. I just want to go back for a moment to this question about Jean Louise not being particularly self-aware, not being fully aware of her own inherent biases. Reading that and reading about her sort of patting herself on the back for not being a racist, for coming back after living in New York to her little southern town and realizing just how twisted it was and how subjugated the African-American residents were, and yet still holding some pretty racist views, caused me to think about the way many of us might do this. Many of us might think, well, it's everybody else who is racist, but there's nothing in my perception of the world that needs to be challenged. And I think if for no other reason, for me, reading Watchmen was valuable for that reason, because it made me think that we may all need to reexamine the things that we're comfortable with regarding our ideas about race.
Sure. The unexamined life is not worth living. Jean Louise is especially opaque to herself. And there's a moment, a conversation between her and Henry, the man she is presumably supposed to marry. And he calls her on her privilege. He points out that he came from a very poor family. In fact, Aunt Alexandra refers to him as trash. He points out the difficulties he had. Jean Louise thinks she hasn't had the same kind of difficulties. And he said, because you're a Finch, you have the privilege of being a Finch. And she's unaware of that. And in some respects, she actually even argues with him about it. A lot of people, especially people, white people who don't think about race as much because they don't have to think about the kind of privilege that they have. That's the position that Jean Louise is in. And in her case, it's not just race privilege. It's economic privilege. There's all kinds of social privilege as well. But she hasn't had the mechanism and she hasn't necessarily taken the time or the responsibility to examine her own privilege and her own relationship to the different cultures she inhabits.
Okay, Jean Louise is and is not a typical 1950s Southern woman. On the one hand, she wants to wear pants and she wants to have a career and she wants to live in the Northeast and kind of have her own life. On the other hand, you know, her aunt, Alexandra, who is kind of a keeper of the old guard and the old ways, says, go put on some lipstick. And Jean Louise marches upstairs and puts on some lipstick. She says, do this. And Jean Louise hops to it. Her father knocks over a glass and she says, sit there. I'll clean that up for you.
Yeah, Jean Louise, at one point, she describes Aunt Alexandra as somebody who thinks the world would be better if everybody just did what they were told. Who wouldn't like that as long as I'm doing the telling, right? Jean Louise resists her aunt, but in the end, she tries to make peace. She tries to make things go smoothly. She doesn't always let that happen. At one point, she tells off her aunt by saying, "Go pee in your hat." That's a big thing for her.
It's very extremely disrespectful given their relationship.
Yes, and she stops short of cussing her because that's the discussion she has with Atticus about that later. So she recognizes the boundaries and she wants to maintain relationships, which is why the novel ends the way it does after a very difficult discussion with Atticus. So Jean Louise, part of her issue is she's just now learning at the age of 26 to interrogate herself. Maybe that's too late. Maybe that's early. Depends on the developmental cycle of the individual. But a lot of what this novel is about Jean Louise thinking, perhaps for the first time, about self-examination.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Chris in Arlington. Hi, Chris.
Hey, thanks for taking my call and letting me join the conversation.
Welcome.
I just find it interesting that the media is out there having such a hard time trying to reconcile these two books. And I have to say up front, I'm a fan and have read To Kill a Mockingbird. I have the book, but I have not read yet Ghost at a Watchman. But it seems to me so straightforward. One is being written by Scout as a young child. That perspective, and the other is being written by Scout, now an adult, and realizing all the horrors that are in this world, and maybe they were not as innocent as you thought when you were a child.
What do you think, Tom?
I think that's right, and I think the point here is it should not be a leap for us to reconcile that a person who is otherwise unerringly ethical can harbor racist beliefs. I'm sure most of us have seen people like this. This is part of the complexity that is Atticus. This is part of the complexity that is the Deep South in the 1950s. So I don't see that as much of a problem. I think what we see I think Chris is right. This is written from the point of view of Scout as a child, then as an adult. One of the things we might think about in terms of why she finds out about Atticus when she's an adult is that she wouldn't have had the tools as a child to have that conversation. She couldn't have asked Atticus the kinds of questions she does when she was 6, 7, 8, 10 years old. No child can do that. So essentially, the adult Jean Louise has a consciousness that can engage with the racist Atticus in a way that the child couldn't.
If Ghost at a Watchman was written first in this period of disillusionment that Harper Lee was having with the character, we know there are autobiographical elements to the novel, and there have been many discussions that you know much more about than I do over just how autobiographical it is. Why do you think then that she came back to a more really lionizing portrayal of Atticus Finch in the novel that she chose to publish?
I think because what the second written novel, what Mockingbird did, was dramatically more subtle and more nuanced than what she was able to do in her first endeavor. I think part of that is because the wise advice of the editor who suggested she write it from the point of view of the child is that the irony that enters into the narrative is what I think appeals to a great many readers. In other words, the child doesn't understand all that she narrates. What that means is that we as readers have to supply that information. We're doing the extra work, which I think is in large part why the book has achieved the popularity it does. It makes us do interesting work in an area in which we are all one way or another engaged in, and that is racial politics in the U.S. So I think what she did in the second book is get a complexity on racial politics in the U.S. that the first book just wasn't equipped to do.
What if Watchmen had come out in, say, 1965? Would it have been forgotten? Would it have caused Mockingbird to be set aside and some other text would have really entered the canon of American literature on race relations in the Deep South?
It's a really interesting question. In 1965, Mockingbird did not have the, let's call it, cult status that it does now. And so it wasn't as ensconced either in the literary scene or in the popular imagination. If Watchmen had come out then, I think it would certainly change the way people read and think about Mockingbird. But I don't think, finally, it would change it that much. Mockingbird is really, in my mind, a kind of tour de force of American literature, and I think it was going to emerge regardless of what kind of distractions occurred. Early reviews of Mockingbird are very mixed. One person called it an impossible book because no child could narrate the way Scout did. A couple other reviewers recognized it as what was going to be an American masterpiece. So I think that Mockingbird, no matter what, was going to achieve the place that it did. The question is, to what extent does Watchmen or would Watchmen back at the time have influenced or inflected the way we think about Mockingbird? And again, I keep wondering, and if there's someone out there, I'd like to hear from them, someone who has read Watchmen without having read Mockingbird. What does that sound like to them?
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Jay is on the line now in Irving. Hello, Jay.
Hi. I was always taught that great art and the literature are made by challenging our expectations and offering something new. And this book definitely does that. It doesn't let Atticus remain the hero we want him to be. So do you think that with the continued scholarship and conversations like this one, this work will be viewed someday as great like Mockingbird is? Or are we living in a world today where people are so entrenched in what they know they like and they don't like that this work will be discarded by the vast majority, even if they haven't read it? And as a second question, do you think the sequel will be added to all those high school literature units?
Wow, that's a really interesting question. Let me address the first part. I agree with you completely, Jay, that great art challenges the way we think and it makes us think in ways that are different. Consequently, Watchmen messes with, it really damages the pedestal on which Atticus has been placed, and I think that's a good thing. We need to recognize the complexity of Atticus as a character and the complexity of U.S. race relations that both Mockingbird and Watchmen take on. I think when you mention even if people are criticizing this, even if they haven't read Watchmen, and I'm really intrigued by this phenomenon. That's certainly the case. Many people have said they're refusing to read Watchmen, and I have a difficult time with that. I can understand if you don't have the time, if it doesn't interest you, but a refusal implies you don't want to change the way you think. And to me, that's not the way an adult approaches things. I don't have the time to read a lot of things, but if something interests me, if it challenges the way I think, you can bet I'm going to go out and read this. And so the challenge question to me is fundamental. I think we all want to reread Mockingbird now to see if the way we read it as children or junior high students maybe needs to be nuanced. Most of us took away from reading Mockingbird the idea that we should all just learn to get along. I would suggest that's a pretty simplistic reading. I think Mockingbird's a lot more complex than that.
I had that experience of reading Mockingbird in middle school and high school and then going back and reading it with my children, you know, decades later. And I was struck on the third reading or second reading, whatever it was, I hadn't really realized what a white book To Kill a Mockingbird is. It is a compelling story. It portrays African Americans as smart and kind and decent in a way that they weren't necessarily portrayed in a lot of white written literature. However, it reserves all the real action, both the hatred and the heroism, for white people.
Absolutely. And in fact, I think that's part of the point that Dana Williams was making in the clip you played earlier. In many respects, and this comes up in Watchmen, whiteness is a form of property. Since in Watchmen, there is a great deal of concern, anxiety about what Aunt Alexandra calls being trash. One of the things we can glean about whiteness in that period, and in many respects, I think this holds true today, that is that people who were economically disadvantaged, white people, the one thing they had that made them different was the whiteness of their skin. So whiteness was a kind of property, and it was something you could deploy to say, I'm better off than that person there. Both Watchmen and Mockingbird are written from the perspective of white people. One might argue, in many respects, they're written for white people. One of the things I like to point out about Mockingbird is just to take the metaphor from the title. It's a sin to kill a mockingbird. A mockingbird is interesting because it imitates the calls of other birds. The African-American characters in Mockingbird and to a lesser extent in Watchmen have to be bilingual. And Calpurnia is explicitly coded as being bilingual. That is, they have to learn a different language to get along in their cultures. And I think that's one of the most powerful messages of Mockingbird. You have to recognize that some people have to become culturally bilingual, linguistically bilingual, because the way they are forced to conform to ways of representing themselves is not necessarily natural.
Thomas DiPiero is my guest. He is dean of the Dedman College of Humanities at SMU. We're talking about Harper Lee's second recently published novel, Go Set a Watchman. If you'd like to join the conversation, we have lines open at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can apply now for fall and design your own master's degree at SMU, a customizable evening master's degree for working professionals. More at smu.edu/MLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with the dean of the Dedman College of Humanities at SMU, Thomas DiPiero. We're talking about Harper Lee's second published novel, Go Set a Watchman. Join us at 800-933-5372. We have to talk about this devastating scene in which Jean Louise goes back to visit the woman who she really thinks of as her mother, Calpurnia, the housekeeper who had all the authority almost of her father in raising Scout and her brother Jem. She's since left the family. Scout goes back to see her. Jean Louise goes back to see her and asks her, "Did you hate us all that time?" and gets a not definitive answer.
That's right. Calpurnia pauses and then she shakes her head at no. Doesn't say anything. That is a very tense moment, especially in the context of Watchmen, where Calpurnia is depicted as very loving of the children, very concerned about them. In Mockingbird, something that comes up in Watchmen, when this is not a spoiler, when Jem, we learn that when Jem died, he's dead from the beginning of the novel. When Jem died, it just tore Calpurnia up. So we have evidence that Calpurnia was invested, involved with the family. Nevertheless, Scout Jean Louise seems to think of Calpurnia as existing only for her. And even as an adult, when she goes back to talk to Calpurnia in the scene you mentioned, and she asks, "Did you hate us?" That to me is not what a 26-year-old woman, the way a 26-year-old woman might really approach that. There's a lot of different shades of meaning in there. So it doesn't have to be either you did or you did not hate us. In the same way that I've been calling for more analysis of the complexity of the Atticus character, Jean Louise doesn't allow for complexity in Calpurnia's character. One could imagine an ambivalent relationship. Yes, she became very invested in the children as she raised them, and at the same time, that was her job. She was paid to do that. So she can be a complex thinker as well.
And did Calpurnia have kids of her own at home that she wasn't with?
In fact, Zeebo.
He's a plot point in the story. We won't spoil that portion of it, but
To Kill a Mockingbird, he's a minor character, but he's her son in that novel as well.
All right, I want to talk about the absence of Jem. We know that in real life, Harper Lee had a brother who died suddenly at the age of 31. This novel opens, Jem is gone. The strange thing about that was not that she chose not to have him alive in this novel, but that she seems not to have mourned for him. She expresses very little other than kind of irritation with him throughout the novel when she thinks back about having been neglected by him because he wanted to go hang out with his friends.
Yeah, in fact, that passage, when he turned 16, I think she says something to the effect of he left her. And there is a sense, and she says she had not much else to do. She hung out with Atticus, and she seemed to feel completely alone at that point. Something, the Jem character in Mockingbird almost drives the story. Something that's always intrigued me is Mockingbird is written in two parts, and both part one and part two open and close with Jem. The first sentence of the novel is about Jem. The end of part one, it closes when Jem throws onto the fire the flower that Mrs. DuBose gave him. Part two opens. The first sentence is something like, Jem was 12 now. And part two concludes, the novel concludes, with Atticus in Jem's room waiting for him to wake up in the morning. So in many respects, it's kind of like Mockingbird is chronicling from a naive, disengaged point of view, Jem's development, Jem's understanding of the complicated issues that surrounds them. Whereas in Watchmen, it goes back to almost the kind of solipsism of Jean Louise trying to figure herself out and her relationship to the two adult figures in her life.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Jim in West Point. Hi, Jim.
Hello, Chris. Good afternoon, Thomas. I have a observation that I'd like you to comment on that seems to me that racism is a byproduct of the existence of two cultures that coexist in close proximity. And there's different values and there's judgments made, and the end product is racism.
I think that's a very good way to begin thinking about the question. I don't think racism is a necessary byproduct of two cultures living in close proximity. I think there's plenty of examples where that happens. I think history, I think when you have two cultures in close proximity, especially with different power relations, different economic relations, that is what allows racism to develop. When one culture allows itself, takes control to become more powerful and dominate another culture. Of course, the proximity is a necessary but not sufficient cause for the development of racism. I think you're right. I would want to nuance that point a bit, however. And I think in some respects, Mockingbird and Watchmen take that question on by looking at – one of the things that both novels do is look at background and pedigree. And what Harper Lee does in both novels is poke fun a little bit at people who place a high – a high value on the nobility of their pedigree.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also email us, think@kera.org. Ashley in Fort Worth wants to know, as someone who has not read either Mockingbird or Watchmen, in what order do you recommend reading them?
Wow. That's a really good question.
Now you've got your test case of someone who's not ready to
read. You can do it either way. You're going to get a different experience either way. I hadn't thought about that, so I'm a little taken off guard. What I would suggest is reading them in the order in which they were written, because if only because from a literary point of view, Mockingbird is such a greater accomplishment. We do know that Watchmen was published without any revisions by the author. I don't know what kind of editing it underwent, but there are some rough spots in it. You will get an entirely different experience, but there's something about reading any literary work in the order in which the author wrote it, because you get to see how that author developed his or her thinking. In this case, Harper Lee became a much more nuanced writer, obviously with the help of an editor. I was talking to someone the other day, a man named Will Evans, who's the editor of Deep Vellum Publishing. His speculation, and he might have a point here, is that the reason Harper Lee never wrote again was because the editing process was so complicated and difficult, she didn't want to go through with it again. And I thought, you know, that might be. In any event, I'd suggest reading them in the order in which they were written. I think the experience of seeing how the thought develops will be very interesting.
It is. It's worth pointing out that Watchmen is a clunkier book. You, if you push through it and then you reward yourself with Mockingbird, it is. You know, there's some dialogue passages and sort of things in Watchmen that just don't feel like great writing.
That's for sure. I think the first chapter of Watchmen is the roughest. There are certainly many clunkers. Adam Gopnik, in a piece in The New Yorker, has pointed out a number of them. It's a really strong piece. I recommend people who are interested in this to turn to that. It's in the most current New Yorker, I think. For example, characters come up without much introduction, almost as though it's assumed we know who they are. And I think some people look at that as evidence that maybe the story we're being told about the birth of Watchmen isn't true. I don't think that's necessarily the case, but there are some real rough moments. Mockingbird is a highly, highly polished novel.
It does seem like Dill didn't need to be included in Watchmen if he's hardly a character and they don't really explain where he is or why he's not around.
Yeah, we do know that Dill's in Italy, that he was in the service. He stayed in Europe. He's not a very developed character. In the flashbacks, which are quite charming, and in the flashback scenes when going back to moments of play among Jem, Scout, and Dill, you get some moments that remind you very much of Mockingbird. Mm-hmm. Dill is there, but he doesn't add much to it. No, it's true.
Toward the end of the novel, Scout is speaking with her Uncle Jack, who in some ways takes on an Atticus-like role, a role similar to Atticus in Mockingbird, in that he's there to help explain some reality to her. And you may disagree with his perspective on things, but he does seem to be more omniscient than Jean Louise herself. But anyway, they're having this discussion, and he throws it out there that the real straw man in the argument against true full civil rights for African Americans and racial integration is that everybody's worried about intermarriage. And Jean Louise says, "Oh well, I wouldn't want that either." And it's an interesting reminder that this is a novel that is 60 years old. Because it's sort of assumed by people here who are grappling with these great issues of race that something like interracial relationships are not going to be on anyone's radar screen.
Yeah, Uncle Jack is a very interesting character. He's kind of unreal because he knows too much. He knows Jean Louise way more than she knows herself, and that's kind of the problem with him. I've been working on a little theory. I think Uncle Jack turns into Boo Radley. There are two things.
Crazy Uncle Jack.
Yeah, there are two things he says that remind us of Boo Radley. One is he says, I think this is not a spoiler either, that Jem and Scott were the children he never had. That's a very powerful situation. At the end of To Kill a Mockingbird, Atticus thanks Boo for his children. And when Scout's narrating, she uses an ambiguous pronoun that sounds as though that Jem and she are Boo's children. The only thing Boo says in Mockingbird is, "Will you take me home?" And it's one of the last things that Uncle Jack says to Jean Louise. Uncle Jack knows everything. Boo is the figure on whom everything is projected.
We'll save the other revelation because I know exactly what you're talking about. Now, the other thing that Uncle Jack tells Jean Louise, which is it's worth reading the story just for that little gem, pardon the pun. Let's go back briefly to the phone now. We have Scott on the line in Dallas. Hey, Scott.
Hi. I think you've actually answered my question earlier when you were talking about potentially that Harper Lee found the editorial process so laborious that was the reason that she never followed up, at least at that time, with a publication. I actually had a question about Uncle Jack's discussion with Scout about the one thing that was incidental to all the questions that she had raised. And rightly or wrongly, I've always thought of the word incidental as being somewhat inconsequential, when in fact he's talking about race, which is very consequential, and I'd like your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think Uncle Jack's point is about heritage, about different cultures, about Jean Louise not understanding that there's two different worlds. In fact, at one point he says something about the South is a separate nation, and he deploys an argument that many historians have deployed, that the Civil War was not about slavery, and I think it's almost disingenuous to me to try to deploy that argument in this context, especially since so much of the novel is about race. To have Uncle Jack say that, and Jean Louise doesn't do very much to counteract that, which again, given the consciousness that she seems to be coming from, is a bit of a surprise. She lets that go with kind of a tacit agreement. So I think that's a very problematic part of the argument. But at the same time, I think what that passage is about is precisely about this kind of argument and why it's so difficult to advance. Uncle Jack seems to know the answer to all the questions that Jean Louise is asking him, and yet he never answers them.
Tom, is it as satisfying to you as a scholar of Harper Lee and one who has read her work time and time again, is it as satisfying to you to have the answers to what another book by her would look like as it was to speculate about what another book like her would look like and what it would have to say?
Yeah, I'm not sure I feel like I have any answers. We have this other book, and after having read it a few times, I think of this as a kind of laboratory. I think this is Harper Lee thinking about what she wanted to do. And I think this is her way of getting her thoughts down on paper, much in the same way that people think out loud before they can really formulate their ideas. And for as interesting as this is as a work in and of itself, I think of it as unfinished, unpolished, and something that will become a far greater, far more interesting, very far more nuanced work.
No doubt in your mind that this was written by Harper Lee, that this wasn't someone else who created a manuscript to look like it was written by Harper Lee?
If they did, they did a great job. There's always been speculation about whether an author is, in fact, the true author of the work. Interestingly, it's more often made about women than men. People think that Harper Lee did not write To Kill a Mockingbird, but that her cousin, Truman Capote, did, which I think is nonsense. But it is interesting to me we say that more about women than men. No, I'm pretty sure Watchmen was written by Harper Lee. There are turns of phrase that you can point to that show up from between both Watchmen and Mockingbird, and it certainly sounds like her voice to me.
Thomas DiPiero is Dean of the Dedman College of Humanities at SMU. Harper Lee's second published novel, Go Set a Watchman, is on sale now. Tom, it's been a really interesting discussion. Thank you for making this time for us.
Thank you. It's been fun for me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. My Twitter handle is at Chris Boyd Think. The show's email is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.